This is the Fighting the Good Fight podcast, defending taxpayers and solving their tax problems, with your host, Patricia Gentile. Patricia Gentile is a taxpayer defense attorney, CPA, the founder of New England Tax Relief, and Patricia L. Gentile Coaching. With 40 years of IRS expertise and experience, she has successfully defended and resolved difficult IRS situations for hundreds of taxpayers. Patricia coaches tax professionals to confidently identify their client's IRS problem and create a successful resolution plan for them. As a fierce advocate, a creative strategist, and solution finder, fighting the good fight with Patricia Gentile is both her passion and purpose to help tax professionals successfully resolve their clients' tax problems.
Welcome, everyone. I'm your host, Patricia Gentile. This is Fighting the Good Fight, defending taxpayers and helping them solve their tax problems. I love this topic today. I find it so important to consider in a plan of resolving your tax problems. I will let our guests talk about how people don't even realize that this can be a part of their plan to resolve their tax debt. Whether it's taxpayers don't think you can discharge tax debt in a bankruptcy, whether there's attorneys or other tax professionals, CPAs or EAs, that are confused about the rules, and they definitely need to hear this podcast. And my guest today, who's an expert in this area, is bankruptcy attorney, Alex Matera. Alex is a partner at Pierce Atwood LLP in Boston, Massachusetts. In his practice, he works with clients to resolve all aspects of bankruptcy, workout, insolvency, and commercial restructuring challenges. Alex, welcome. I really appreciate you taking the time to do this. And I'm going to give you the floor. Go right ahead.
Patricia, thank you very much. Thank you for having me on. I'm glad you reached out on this. With tax and bankruptcy, there's an intersection of what could be two challenging worlds. And when they intersect, it compounds that challenge to try to navigate a path between the two. And maybe as a start, it helps to orient your listeners that bankruptcy involves a lot of competing interests. And expectations coming into bankruptcy are often counterintuitive. The real beneficiaries of a bankruptcy are often the creditors, because it creates a level playing field, it creates an equitable treatment and priority scheme for paying out claims, and it really protects and serves their interests. There's also, of course, the competing interest of the debtor, who wants a fresh start, wants to get rid of all those old debts. And when you throw in tax claims, you now have the yet again competing interest of the taxing authorities, who have a different perspective than an ordinary trade creditor or any non-governmental unit. They don't have a balance sheet that they're trying to justify to shareholders, but they do have a collection prerogative. They also, of course, have an incentive to achieve the enforcement of the tax code. And it's not always an economic win for them. Sometimes it's more of an enforcement win. And so when you put all those competing interests into the same arena, there needs to be a roadmap on how to resolve those kinds of disputes. And fortunately for us, the bankruptcy code provides a roadmap. We were talking a little before the show about tax professionals have a code. And it's so comforting to be able to go back to that code and say, well, I can look it up. I know where it is. I can read the notes from the commissioner and figure out how to apply it. And bankruptcy practitioners are on the same wavelength. We have a code. We have history for the code. We have cases interpreting it. And it really does help to inform our clients and to set expectations for how these kinds of disputes will be resolved. So really, the first stop in analyzing a tax question in bankruptcy is to look to the code, look to the sections that address it, and figure out how it gets applied. Probably the biggest challenge for us is that many people come to bankruptcy with misunderstanding of how it treats tax claims. And that happens in both directions. We get folks who come in thinking, well, I have these massive tax problems. Thank goodness I can file bankruptcy and get rid of all my taxes. Mm-hmm. And then we have folks who come in and have tax debts from long ago and think, well, I can't ever get out of these. So how can bankruptcy even help me? And both are wrong in different ways. And certainly there's some middle ground where you might be able to get some benefit. Maybe I'll jump right into some of the rules of thumb about how to treat taxes in bankruptcy. First and foremost, bankruptcy is a great way to get a breathing spell for a beleaguered debtor who's getting demands, getting pressure, maybe economic consequences. The problem is the minute they file, they think, well, now I can not only breathe, but I can relax and maybe stop doing what I'm supposed to be doing. And that is not the case when it comes to taxes, and in a unique way. Many other things the debtor can ignore once they file, but they can't ignore their tax obligations that continue to accrue post-bankruptcy. That means they have to file their returns. That means they have to pay their tax liability. That means they need to keep current on all of that stuff. And it also looks backwards. If they're looking for bankruptcy relief, they have to have filed the last four returns for the four pre-petition tax periods, most recent tax periods. So they need to be somewhat current in order to even file for bankruptcy. So they have to catch up, then they have to maintain and keep current as they go through. Assuming they can do that, the bankruptcy does achieve a benefit for them. That automatic stay does stop litigation. It does stop levies and garnishments and other collection efforts, at least temporarily. It'll create a breathing spell while the debtor figures out what's its path, what's the best way to address these claims, can they be resolved. It also creates space for some negotiation with the taxing authority and enforcement, whether that's a repayment plan, whether that's obtaining court approval of a bankruptcy plan. It creates the space to negotiate that plan. And then finally, an unofficial benefit to filing is typically it's going to change who you're dealing with at the taxing authority. Virtually every taxing authority I've dealt with has a special department to handle bankruptcy. And once you file, your file, not to repeat myself, gets transferred over to the bankruptcy department. So maybe the revenue officer who you were fighting with pre-bankruptcy is now off the case and a different person is looking at it. That could be helpful if there's a history there, if there is some burned credibility or other conflict in the past. It also will set the taxing authority's expectations. They obviously have a lot more experience with this than the usual taxpayer, and they know that when a bankruptcy is filed, their rights can be affected, and they take that into account as they negotiate repayment plans and treatment of bankruptcy. So there's some sort of ancillary benefit to filing, to move that file out to perhaps a more amenable office to negotiate with.
That's a great point. I like that. That's absolutely how it works. I wanted to just go back to you talking about filing compliance. I tend to have tax cases where I have non-filers of anywhere from 6 to 10 years. You were mentioning about that the IRS requires filing of returns for the last four pre-petition tax periods. So what happens about the years before those four when it comes to filing a bankruptcy petition?
That's a great question. And maybe we'll get lost in a little bit of detail here, but gosh, if the tax code and the bankruptcy code aren't detailed, I don't know what is. So right. It's necessary to look at it. And there are a few rules of thumb in treating bankruptcy tax claims. One is the 3-year rule, the 2-year rule, and the 240-day rule. And just taking those in order, the 3-year rule is that generally a debtor is going to be able to discharge tax liabilities that arose for periods more than 3 years prior to the filing. And I say generally because there are some requirements. One of those requirements is that it's either that arose or were assessed. And as a tax professional, you understand the distinction between assessment and arising. A taxpayer filing their return doesn't necessarily trigger assessment. Not filing a return doesn't necessarily trigger assessment.
Right.
That's a term of art, and it's a knowable date. So that you need to know that date when you're preparing the schedules. It also requires that the debtor actually file returns for the periods that they want to discharge at least 2 years prior to the petition date. So that's the 2-year rule.
Right.
So they can't catch up on 6 years of returns the day before they file and expect to discharge those debts. And some of the rationale there is public policy rationale. How is the taxing authority going to review those returns to see if they're appropriate if they're filed on the eve of the bankruptcy? Whereas if they're filed 2 years prior, they've had an ample opportunity and could be held to having not challenged them prior to the bankruptcy filing.
Good point.
Right. And then the 240-day rule is that assessment deadline. So that date's got to pass. And typically, the taxes are going to be assessed long before on tax claims that are more than 3 years old at the petition date, but it's possible they wouldn't. So that's a date to be wary of for practitioners. If you can trigger all those, you can discharge taxes that are more than 3 years old. And as I say, most people come into a bankruptcy lawyer's office thinking that there's no way out of their tax obligations. They've sort of got this general sense from who knows what source that some stuff you can't get rid of, and taxes and maybe student loans and maybe divorce obligations are the kinds of things that don't go away.
Right.
And that's true for some taxes, as we talked about recent taxes, but older taxes can and routinely are discharged in bankruptcy if they can meet those requirements. But all of this comes from your question about filing requirements. And you really do, when you meet with a debtor, need to get on top of what's been filed for tax returns, when were they filed, because that will be your first point of determination as to whether bankruptcy will actually be a help to them. In the bankruptcy, you do have some ways to treat the tax claims. And maybe it makes sense to talk a little bit about the different chapters of bankruptcy relief that are available, as an overview.
Yeah, that'd be a good idea.
In bankruptcy, what we normally hear about is Chapter 7, Chapter 11. Maybe if you're a little more focused, you've heard of Chapter 13. And Chapter 7 is the liquidation chapter. That's the going out of business for a company. It's an individual getting rid of their debts through a discharge. And that's available to any entity. For personal bankruptcy, the goal is a discharge to wipe out that debt. For a corporate bankruptcy, there's no discharge, and it's a little less critical because the company is going to cease to exist. So the relief for the company is less material. My only caution about a corporate bankruptcy in a Chapter 7 is, and not that this affects the filing decision, but the filer should be aware, it can have the effect of triggering increased collection efforts against principals of the company. Mm-hmm. From a tax collecting perspective, that might mean, for instance, a responsible party, a responsible person for things like trust fund taxes.
Right.
Ordinarily, that's available to the taxing authority anyway. But when the company ceases to be an avenue of recourse, it certainly spotlights the individual and it may amplify or accelerate the collection effort of the taxing authority. So something to be aware of. Chapter 11 is the opposite of a liquidation. That's the I'm going to stay in business and reorganize my debts. We usually see this on the corporate side, but it is also available to individuals. And that is a very flexible option where the debtor, whether it's a person or a company, can negotiate a repayment plan with its creditors, all within the confines of the bankruptcy code, but they do provide broad leeway for negotiating that. And then somewhere in the middle is Chapter 13, which is available only to individuals. And it could be thought of as a very streamlined Chapter 11. It provides that same reorganization option where the Chapter 13 debtor enters a repayment plan and pays some portion of what's owed. That repayment plan is very formulaic. It's driven by the bankruptcy code, by the debtor's income and expenses as disclosed in its schedules. Again, it's only available to individuals. And at the end of the process, whatever they haven't repaid through the plan is discharged, with, of course, some exceptions. And one of those exceptions is certain tax claims. Assuming that a debtor chooses to file, as we talked about, they've still got the obligation of maintaining their current tax filings. And of course, the only taxes that can be treated in a bankruptcy are the pre-bankruptcy taxes. And we say petition, so pre-petition taxes,
right.
Post-petition taxes arising from the day of the bankruptcy filing onward are due and owing and unaffected by the bankruptcy. That means the debtor will owe them. They won't be discharged. It also means the debtor will have to pay them when they're due. There's no stay of the debtor's obligation to do that, even if the bankruptcy remains pending for a length of time. The effect of that is that if the case is dismissed, the taxing authority can retain any payments that were made during the pendency and then go after the remaining liability. And the time period in which the taxing authority is able to do that, the statutes of limitation are extended. Bankruptcy effectively stays them while it's pending.
People want to know what happens with the accrued interest and penalties on their tax debt when they file in a bankruptcy.
That's a great question. So the general rule of thumb is that the interest and penalties follow the claim in terms of treatment. So that if the claim is dischargeable because it's old and the other requirements have been met, the interest and penalties attributed to that claim would be dischargeable. If the claim is not dischargeable, neither would the interest and penalties be. They would follow the claim and continue to be collectible post-bankruptcy. Again, that's a general rule. The bankruptcy code contains a waterfall of how funds are distributed. And there are priority claims, which are paid first, thus the name, and then general non-priority claims, which are paid last. Priority claims are listed in priorities and sometimes limited by amount, not just kind, for a host of obligations. So you get through that scheme of priorities all the way down to taxes and beyond, and then you're in the pool of general unsecured claims. That's everything else. And for most credit or debtors, that's everything. Most debtors don't have priority claims unless they have tax liability or divorce obligations or something else. But the vast majority of claims that we talked about earlier, hospital bills, credit card bills, utility bills, rent bills, those are all general non-priority claims.
I hate to throw a little wrench in this, but can we talk about liens?
Yes, tax liens are obviously a very powerful collection tool for the agency. And for debtors in bankruptcy, there are two chief benefits regarding exemptions. First, they get them, right? There's an exemption scheme in bankruptcy where a debtor can identify all these different properties by class, typically with an amount of limitation for the value, and they can exempt them, meaning those assets are not available for their creditors. They can't be sold or liquidated. They can't be leaned up. There's also the potential for creditors to avoid liens that are already in place. And that's a limited right of debtors to remove liens, typically from a residence. But that does not extend to tax liens. Tax liens have special priority and protection in bankruptcy. A debtor cannot claim an exemption from a tax lien in property. So if the taxing authority got the lien, they're going to keep that lien post-bankruptcy. It also allows them, because it's a statutory lien, to come ahead of the debtor's homestead. So for most debtors, the most valuable asset they have is their home. Sometimes the only equitable asset they have is their home. And the homestead protection statute in Massachusetts is fairly generous. It just became a lot more generous. It sort of slipped in under the radar. It was a $500,000 limit up until just recently. It's jumped to $1 million. It was not publicized. Oh, wow.
I didn't know that either.
It was not publicized. It came in under the radar. Even us bankruptcy attorneys who deal with it constantly weren't aware that it was up for consideration. And it was part of a package of other legislation.
Wow.
And that amount just doubled. That's a great tool for debtors. The issue is, again, homestead is on a microcosm like tax claims in that it's specialized and not everyone understands it. It does not protect a debtor against consensual liens like a mortgage, obviously. It also does not protect a debtor against statutory liens like tax liens. And so those will tend to ride through bankruptcy and they'll keep their lien on that property. The debtor will not be able to escape it. So that's a real issue. And the only benefit for the debtor really is to try to get the bankruptcy filed before those liens happen, because right. The automatic stay will prevent them arising, but only if the case is filed before they arise. So part of the pre-bankruptcy planning is to understand those deadlines, to understand the real effect of the bankruptcy filing, to understand whether tax claims or liens will survive, and to assess whether you can provide meaningful relief to that debtor or whether it's going to be an expensive exercise. And the debtor does not want to discover that after the case has been filed and it's too late.
Right.
And who are they going to turn around and blame if that happens? But of course, the practitioner.
Right.
So spend the time before the filing. It may mean that cases come in that aren't worth filing, and that's okay. Giving the right advice to the debtor is more valuable than bringing in that client that you're not going to be able to adequately serve.
What do you do to analyze someone's tax debt records to actually evaluate whether bankruptcy is an option for them?
It's harder than it should be. And particularly for non-tax practitioners, as a bankruptcy lawyer, I don't have the contacts and the experience necessary to gather that information. So for me, it starts with the debtor and the debtor producing voluntarily what they have in terms of filed returns, correspondence, and so on. But debtors are notoriously unreliable. That's the reason they're debtors. And so only so much of information will be available or confirmable. The next step would be to work with the debtor's accountant if they have one, but unsophisticated debtors, often delinquent debtors, don't have accountants or not reliable ones who can provide that information. Your next stop would be to go to the taxing authorities, but getting a tax transcript is probably the most encapsulated way of gathering that information. It doesn't provide the actual material, but it at least gives you some dates and some holes that need filling. And then, you know, it might require getting a power of attorney or requesting records from the taxing authorities so that you can gather that information. You know, that's a somewhat cumbersome process in terms of time, not money, but money from a debtor's perspective if they're having their attorney do it. And for some debtors, that might be the only reliable way is to turn it over to their attorney so that the attorney has reliance that the information's accurate. So it's a difficult process. And certainly you're advising your client, my services are only as good as what you provide me with for information. Yeah. And so if I'm advising you that filing makes sense, it's on the basis of the information I've been able to gather that you've confirmed. If that turns out not to be true, my analysis might not be the same. And at some point, that's what you go forward with.
Is there anything else that maybe we didn't cover that you'd like to mention here?
The only other thing that comes to mind is, you know, the terrible irony that if you can eliminate a tax debt, you might have a tax problem because the elimination of the debt's going to create income from the discharge of indebtedness. That's not necessarily the case, but it often is the case. In bankruptcy, if you discharge a debt through bankruptcy, there's no income attributed to the discharge of the indebtedness under the statute. That's under Title 26. So that any debts you can get rid of in a bankruptcy, you can get rid of tax-free, so to speak. Whereas outside of a bankruptcy, typically you're going to have imputed income and you'll have a 1099 or some other tax reporting event, and you'll owe taxes on the taxes that you got rid of, which again, people don't expect and obviously can be really burdensome. There are ways to avoid those taxes from the discharge of indebtedness, but it's not nearly so easy outside of bankruptcy as it is in. In bankruptcy, it's automatic. Outside of bankruptcy, the obligations on the taxpayer to demonstrate why they should be exempt from that imputation of the income. So that's one other reason why, if you're resolving tax debts, bankruptcy can offer broader relief than doing it outside of bankruptcy.
You know, if there's anything you can elaborate to let people know that this isn't something for them to feel ashamed about, you know, how do you speak to potential clients or clients who are ashamed to even do this, but know they need the help?
That's a great question, Patricia. And I have to say, most folks have a great prejudice against bankruptcy, and it's typically unfounded. And when I say most folks, I mean people who aren't contemplating filing bankruptcy, but creditors, members of the public, who have this sense that people file bankruptcy willy-nilly after maybe a lavish lifestyle running up irresponsible debts. And then, of course, they wipe them all out and do it again. My experience now in over a quarter of a century of doing this has been quite the opposite. And a typical bankruptcy case might involve a family that suffered a job loss, a divorce, catastrophic illness, and they've carried the associated debt with that event sometimes for a decade or more. While it's piled up and they've tried to make minimum payments and they've tried to make negotiated payment plans, and they finally hit a wall where they either can't do it anymore or they suffer another catastrophic event, and finally they've got to consider bankruptcy, they always wait too long. They always try too long outside of bankruptcy to meet their obligations. And it's never been my experience that people come in with a cavalier attitude of amassing debt and then eliminating it without carrying the burden of trying to repay it and really meaningfully trying to sacrifice to repay it. So I welcome the opportunity to sort of set that straight, that usually people make a very strong effort and are just overwhelmed. As far as reassuring them about the economic impact of their filing, their credit score is already as low as it can be. They are such a terrible credit risk when they come to see me that filing can only improve it. And maybe I'm cynical, but they become a much better credit risk in bankruptcy and after they filed than they ever were before. And credit or debtors who file will start receiving solicitations from credit companies, credit cards, and other solicitations almost immediately after the filing. These are public filings. They pull the records and they start soliciting new credit arrangements with the debtor, recognizing that the debtor now has a discharge. There's no other debt to compete with. They want to be first in line as this debtor tries to establish new credit and maybe rebuild credit. And so there's an opportunity for the debtor to rehabilitate themselves post-bankruptcy by responsibly using and building their credit that is not achievable outside of bankruptcy. They're not going to be able to dig out of that mess and restore their score. So that fresh start, that wiping the slate clean, really can be achieved in a bankruptcy. And then it's a matter of, you know, consistent months with that little green box on their credit report showing a timely payment that will rebuild it much more quickly. My only other thought would be, if they specifically have a tax problem, it's almost always not their only problem. And they would be better served by filing a bankruptcy to eliminate as much non-tax debt as they can in order to focus the available dollars on a tax plan to repay that debt and not be trying to put out 100 fires at once, but to focus on the, frankly, the most threatening one, which for most people will be the taxing authorities. And so there could still be a benefit, even if they can't discharge the tax debt, to at least eliminating the other debts that are distracting them and taking up resources.
That's awesome. I love that. It gives people a lot of hope. And I think it can change how people are seeing how beneficial bankruptcy can be too. Very beneficial. Alex, thank you so much. You're an expert in this, in your field and its area. Please let our listeners know how they can reach you.
Patricia, thank you so much for having me. As you said, I'm a partner here in the Boston office of Pierce Atwood LLP. My email is simple. It's amatera, A-M-A-T-T-E-R-A, at pierceatwood.com. And they're always welcome to call the office, 617-488-8112. And like you, I'm happy to talk with people and find out whether I could be a good fit or help them find somebody who can. So people shouldn't hesitate to call, even if it's not an engagement. I'm still happy to help out.
Thank you so much. I can't thank you enough. It was awesome to speak with you and to see you. Thank you.
As always, a lot of fun to talk with you. Thank you.
We hope you are enjoying this episode of the Fighting the Good Fight podcast. Make sure you don't miss a moment by simply subscribing on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We are also excited to announce that the Fighting the Good Fight podcast is now available on YouTube. Just search Fighting the Good Fight podcast with Patricia Gentile, and while you're there, give us a like. The Fighting the Good Fight podcast is a Park City Productions presentation. Learn more at Park City Productions 06604 on Facebook or Instagram. I'm Patricia Gentile, and we'll see you next time.